This is part two. Sorry about that. Jus cogens basically means you can't, it is foundational to the point that you cannot override it. For example, you cannot have a treaty that allows genocide. That is something that international law would refuse to recognize. That's a drastic example. But another Jus cogens principle, for example, would be nations that have signed onto the UN Charter have also agreed that the UN Charter will override any attempt of a treaty to conflict with the obligations of the UN Charter. So in a way, that's almost a made form of Jus cogens. But these are key things here. They're rare, they're powerful, they cannot be overridden. To a certain extent, they're the trump card. They're like an international version of a constitutional principle. I use that very guardedly. Be careful with that, because you can get very confused if you mix those two up. But the bottom line is it is sort of an principle. It's one that you really have to respect no matter what the treaty or the customary law might say.
Think of it as an international human rights sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
Jus cogens actually arises from the conduct of nations typically, and it's so foundational it can't be questioned anymore. And that any attempt to try and shift it gets overridden by the Jus cogens principle. I think. The last one's my favorite, number four. Learned commentary from academics. Us. The ICJ, arbitrators, international bodies will look to law review articles to determine what international law is. So you guys have the power. There are certain professors who basically, their textbooks are international law. They don't report it, they make it, which is very cool. But nonetheless, it's a recognized source of international law going back centuries. So those are the big four. Any questions about how those are, how they operate, especially in the ally of sovereignty, the fact that we basically have a consensual governance system where the parties have to either yield their sovereignty to allow international enforcement, or you have to find ways for nations to coerce each other to act in accordance with their obligations. Because think about how that would apply in the context of climate change. Climate change is almost the perfectly designed problem to challenge this system. And think about that. We'll come back to the end of class. But yeah, we talk about being a super wicked problem. It's a particularly super wicked problem for international law. So with that in mind, that's international. Now, of course, what I care about, and I tend to harp on it, but I think it's important, I feel like I'm leaving a few things behind. Bear with me. There are a couple of markers I want to leave with you guys that we can come back to. We're going to turn next to how international law is a factor in U.S. law. But there are a couple of things I want to make sure we don't forget, because they've popped up before and they will pop up again when we look at climate treaties. There are certain customary international law principles that are very important to climate change law. One is common but differentiated responsibility. I'm going to ask your indulgence and simply give you the concept, quickly describe it, then save our discussion for our next couple of classes, particularly with the UNFCC and the Kyoto Protocols. This is the idea that we all share responsibility, but how much we have to lift is determined by our individual circumstance. It's unfair to expect India to do the same thing as the United States. That's what it's at its heart. The second is the precautionary principle. This is the idea that if a risk of harm is dramatic and irreversible, you don't necessarily have to wait for certainty before action. That's a very, unfortunately, crude formulation of a very contentious and important concept, but the key thing here is don't wait. One of the biggest barriers for action on the international level was the need for assessment and analysis of what was causing climate change and what could be done about it. This principle says basically you don't need to hold your hand while you study and investigate. I think the last one I'll put here is intergenerational equity. This is the idea, basically, that the future has a say, that international law gives some weight to the concerns of generations yet unborn, and that for sustainable development purposes, for equity, justice principles, it is a principle of international law that you need to consider intergenerational equity of future generations. Does that make sense, everybody? We'll come back to all three of these, but they're important enough, I want to make sure I didn't ignore them. All right. So what? If this is all the law of nations, and the United States basically just deals with other nations, why do we care? What relevance does it have in the United States inside our borders? And for that, the critical question is, basically, what, you know, is U.S. law encompassing of international law? Is international law U.S. law? And here we get to our reading for today, which I thought was, I will also confess to you, of all the readings of the semester, this is the shortest reading that's also probably the densest reading. But Professor Henkin is a wonderful scholar. He actually wrote the Restatement of Foreign Relations Law of the United States. Brilliant man. So with that in mind, I will pause here, because I've been talking at you guys a lot for the past couple of minutes. That's the foundational question. Is international law part of U.S. law? How so?
Because of the incorporation of it within the Supremacy Clause, or as it's called, the law. But it seems to be from the reading that, I guess the author disagrees with a decision saying this isn't the case, but basically that it's the law that can be subsequently replaced by some act of Congress.
Okay.
So it's almost like it's the common law in the U.S. in a way.
Well, yes, but I want to think about this. I mean, let's start with our list here. Our treaties laws of the United States. Why?
Because they're ratified by the Senate, so they are incorporated into the U.S. system.
Mm-hmm. And actually, it's one of the few things actually I could resist. I found myself looking at the original constitutional provisions. It's one of the few sources of international law that are expressly endorsed in the Constitution as the laws of the United States. So, but that's because they're passed by Congress, right? What if they're not passed by Congress? Put this way. Let's keep our eye on the ball. We can come back to that sort of narrower question. Treaties are considered laws of the United States just like a statute. So that means for supremacy clause purposes, you treat them in the same way. If you have a treaty that is more recent in time than a federal statute, the treaty overrides the statute, and vice versa. The United States has the capacity, and we'll talk about how this all plays out in permutations, to basically pass a law saying we plan to violate international law. Our statute dictates that. As part of our sovereignty, we have that freedom, and that law is binding within our borders. There is no unconstitutionality associated with violating an international norm. It just simply means that you have to determine what Congress means, what it meant to do, and that standard supremacy clause analysis, usually later in time, prevails. So for U.S. law, treaties, absolutely. Now, a couple of quick catches. One is it a self-executing treaty? What does that mean? It means you could have a treaty that the United States has signed into that doesn't take effect in the United States until Congress passes a statute to actually implement it. For example, we are parties to a treaty called the London Convention, which deals with pollution on the high seas. We had to pass a separate statute in the United States, the Oil Pollution Act, to implement our obligations under the treaty. Some treaties bypass that. They say, when you adopt this treaty, boom, it applies. It's self-executing. You don't need statutes. Most treaties, though, are not self-executing. You need to have some form of federal legislation to implement it. Second is, what happens if Congress doesn't pass it? What if they decide not to ratify it? What if the executive branch negotiates a treaty and says, we're not going to submit this to the Senate. We don't think it'll pass. Instead, we're just going to say it as an executive agreement and lodge it.
But even if you don't ratify it, if you act on it, after a number of years, the international community recognizes it, right? But you're held accountable to responsibilities.
Well, you're held accountable from the international community's perspective, regardless of whether the Senate advises or consents to it.
Yeah.
Their application from their perspective is irrelevant. The United States, through the sole organ of the president, I should pause there. All right, we're about to go off on a detour, but I promise I'll be brief. I'm assuming you all have, from your con law days, fond recollections, the professor talking about the foreign affairs powers and how it's divided up between the three branches. Basically, the president is the sole organ for the United States in representing us in the international community. This president negotiates treaties. He or she is the one who's responsible for pursuing claims if someone violates international laws in a way that harms the United States. Congress ratifies treaties. Congress essentially plays a role in declaring war. But the president, as supreme commander of the armed forces, has the ability to send the armed forces into harm's way even without a declaration of war. So there's a rough, soft, unclear division of power between Congress and the president, with the president and the executive branch assuming more and more power as part of being the sole organ for foreign diplomacy. And the courts basically have power. In this context, we're talking about how to interpret and apply the law in cases. But that's, they've striven hard not to have a larger role outside of that. And we can talk about political question doctrine a little bit later in the semester. Does that make sense for everybody? Okay. So with that in mind, treaties are laws of the United States. Even if Congress doesn't pass a treaty, if that treaty has international binding effect, it could be deemed to be an international legal obligation that has force under U.S. law. We'll talk about how these all interrelate with each other in just a second. What about customary international law? Is that a law of the United States? Should it be? And as you think about your answer, consider what you may be buying into as binding legal principles on U.S. citizens.
It would be nice if international law, I think, was U.S. law, but I'm not someone who's that read up on what the actual history of international law is. I assume I'd pick and choose certain ones. It would be nice if America was participating in an international system rather than simply being a nation state that can do whatever it wants. It's not particularly conducive to a healthy world. One huge powerful country being able to ignore international law.
But absolutely, and I think everyone agrees the United States should be a member of the Community of Nations. But we're asking a slightly different question right now, which is, should it be a U.S. law applying to its citizenry? If there's an international principle, does that translate down to a courts?
I think it sets a bad precedent for the U.S. letting some supranational principle rule its citizens when our form of government is made to be run by the citizenry. And I think it sets a bad precedent in that we're kind of giving up some of our sovereignty as a nation state. And it would be a good example, and we are a hegemonic power, but it's still
good. Careful, throwing around the word hegemonic. You know, there's some political package statements in there. But anyway, sorry, Maria?
I mean, customary law is, it's not about whether you want to give up rights or not. It's just part of the international community. So if you are, that law is enforceable to you. And nations and states, as part of their sovereign power, choose to abide by that customary law by coding and codifying it and entering it into international legislation. So that's how you make customary law applicable in a domestic sense, right? The domestic governments make it pass legislation based on that customary law.
And I think all three of you are correct, which sounds crazy. But Chris is correct in that customary international law has to have some relevance within our borders. Otherwise, as a matter of international legal obligations, we dilute enormously its real effect. We also don't want to give up our sovereignty. So to a certain extent, we need to retain our ability to basically tell the international community to go pound salt. This comes back to your earlier answer, which I think you were trying to think of the case name. The answer to this is yes, thanks to the Paquette Habana. Paquette Habana is an obscure case, but an enormously important one, where essentially the Supreme Court said flat out that the law of the United States incorporates, almost by reference, the law of customary law of nations. So effectively, think of it as common law, federal common law, that the United States has either, one, had baked into its DNA, because when we created the United States, all those customary international norms were out there. So the founding fathers meant for that to be part of the starting set of laws that we agreed to follow when we became a nation. Second, we also have essentially agreed to be as part of this community in law, to follow those customary norms, because presumably we're part of the community of nations that agreed to them through our conduct, through our belief of the opinion of yours. So to a certain extent, the United States is not having it forced on them. We have been part of the community of nations that have created these norms. Does that make sense for everybody? Not quite sold, but we'll get there. Okay.
Well, maybe not today.
Those are the two big ones. Let me throw a couple more up here real quickly. I've kind of talked about this a little bit. What if you don't have a treaty, you just have an executive order from the president? Is that a matter of U.S. law if it deals with a foreign relations issue? I think I'd save us some time on this one and just simply say, hell yeah. And this is clearly U.S. law. To the extent that it creates a binding legal norm or legal obligation that must be followed by an individual citizen. And then the last, just because I don't want to forget these poor guys, they always do get forgotten. Where do the states fit in all this? Suppose Texas, in a fit of pique, passed a law saying that they refuse to, they refuse to allow any citizen of another nation to carry a firearm within the state borders unless that nation allows Texas citizens to carry free carry firearms within the border of the foreign nation. If I were to carry my rifle in Saudi Arabia or Germany, and Saudi Arabia and Germany say, hell no way, then anyone from Germany or Saudi Arabia can't carry a firearm at all inside of Texas. State law, foreign relations impact, can the state do that? Why not?
That's power reserved for the federal government.
Where?
Commerce Clause.
That gives Congress the power to regulate if it chooses to.
Isn't that something? Do we do this in this class where we talk about the...
They're all starting to blend together, aren't they?
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
The implicit reverse, it's like something implicit in the Commerce Clause where it says that, yeah, like the federal government can regulate interstate commerce, which implicitly means that the states unduly interfere with interstate commerce. Mm-hmm. I guess that's internally, though. So.
No, you're on the right track.
Yeah, like it's implicit, and maybe it's implicit in the federal government's power to deal with mm-hmm. foreign states, and subdivisions can't deal with foreign states.
Yeah, absolutely. Put it this way, bar review flashback for everyone around the table, Dormant Commerce Clause. We're not talking Dormant Commerce Clause here. We're actually talking about the allocation of foreign affairs power to the executive and Congress. Even though it's messed between the two of them, it's clear that the federal government, between the two of them, has the dominant exclusive authority for foreign relations. States cannot pass laws or ordinances or regulations that interfere with the exercise of foreign affairs power. For example, San Diego passed an ordinance saying that no nuclear-powered vessel could dock in their harbor. And that was struck down because it was an impermissible interference with foreign affairs of the United States. Does that make sense for everybody? So, if there's not that interference, in theory, states can pass some laws. But I'll be honest with you, it's fairly circumscribed. California, for example, passed a law requiring that insurance companies had to provide information about life insurance policies held by Holocaust survivors, and also families that were lost in the Holocaust. And that was struck down as impermissibly interfering with negotiations with Germany for reparations. So with that in mind, short answer here, we have sorts of international law. They carry over almost directly into US law. And treaties are law of the land. Customary international law is also law of the land. What happens when they start conflicting with each other? How do you decide, how does a court decide which one takes precedence? What's the priority? And let's give this a shot. Executive order and states. Treaties, customary, executive orders, states. This will sort of help us think through what happens when they conflict. What happens if you have two treaties that conflict? Which one predominates?
Sorry? You end up in a convention of the interpretation of treaties, and then you kind of make it work together.
Well, if you can. If you can harmonize them, let's assume they're just point, they just cannot be reconciled.
The most recent one, right?
Right. Last in time prevails. Just like with statutes. You try and interpret the statutes that can be harmonized, and try and preserve what portions of the statutes you can, but if they can't be, you presume that the most recent one expresses the predominant will of the bodies of the nations. Sorry. At this case, the most recent treaty is adopted by Congress ratification, reflects the will of Congress at this point. What happens if a treaty conflicts with customary international law?
Most recent as well. But I guess the customary would be like quite old.
Well?
Well, I guess the Beijing one could overwrite the treaty, right?
I like where you're going.
Actually, I want to say most recent for both, but I also kind of feel like because customary law has to be sort of adopted by the state, that even a treaty before the customary law might indicate that the state isn't consenting to the customary, or that it's rejecting it.
Well, first of all, let me save a little bit of time. Would y'all agree if I just did a diagonal here? That whenever you have a like-like conflict, they're almost always going to be most recent. Any arguments or objections to that? Okay, so treaty versus customary international law. I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm going to put murky. But I think Chris's intuition is right. Usually, treaties, by almost definition, are more specific, they're more concrete, they more reflect the expressed will of the United States and the other nation that they're dealing with. Customary international law tends to be evolving and murky and harder to discern. So I'll be honest with you. Usually with court, given a choice between customary and treaties, they'll go with treaties. But I also think Chris's intuition is accurate. What happens if you have the Treaty of 1789, which is now in conflict with an emerging customary international norm that the United States has signed on to and everybody else agrees with is the right way to go? There are cases where you can make the argument that the customary norm supersedes the treaty. But they're rare, I'll be honest with you. Almost always, it's treaty. Okay. Again, and they'll go more quickly with the other columns. What happens when the treaty conflicts with an executive order? Now, I should pause for a moment, and I realize I might not have given you all a little bit as much information as you would like here. An executive order essentially is a unilateral action by the White House to declare that the United States is going to take a position or action in accordance with an international legal commitment. For example, they can resolve claims. If someone expropriates property. The White House, through executive order, can essentially settle those claims and resolve other international disputes unilaterally. They can also exist through executive orders that state what the position of the United States is on a legal principle. Usually, executive orders have been deemed under international law to have binding effect, like other international actions by party actors. So what happens if you have a treaty that conflicts an executive order? Short answer here, same. Why? Executive orders are unilateral actions, which means almost by definition a treaty, which is almost always the action of both branches, tends to be the zenith of expression of federal power in foreign affairs. Back to our Curtis Wright case, you may recall from constitutional law. So here, the treaty almost always wins over an executive order. There are rare circumstances where an executive order may be more current than a prior treaty, and it falls in like a gap where the treaty doesn't clearly get to. But usually the courts are going to go with a treaty over an executive order. Last, what happens if you have a treaty that conflicts with state law? That was easy. Yeah, states almost always lose when it comes to foreign affairs. Okay. Same thing here. We're going to see a repeat. If you have customary treaties, you're going to see that it's murky, but generally the treaty is going to prevail. We've already talked about how customary law interacts with customary international law. The most recent tends to prevail. With a small exception, don't forget Jus Cogens, that sort of trump card. If I have a Jus Cogens principle, it's older. The newer attempt to create customary international law may not prevail against that older foundational principle. What else if an executive order conflicts with customary international law? Can the president basically issue an executive order without Congress's consent saying, pshaw, this customary international norm is ridiculous. We refuse to accede to it. And a court has to decide.
Yes.
Why?
Because the president is the sole organ of our foreign affairs. And by him making that decision, he's expressing that power.
So I'm going to put here, it's actually a little bit murky, but you're right. Almost always, the executive order is going to prevail for some of the same reasons we talked about with treaties versus customary international law.
But if it's Jus Cogens, even if it's an executive order, Jus Cogens wins.
Of course, that's the whole reason to have a Jus Cogens.
Yeah.
If I could override Jus Cogens with an executive order, having said that, federal courts are extremely reluctant to recognize Jus Cogens because for the very same reason we talked about, sovereignty tends to be predominant. But what they might do is find that the executive order is invalid because it conflicts with the Jus Cogens principle the United States previously decided they were going to comply with. And states versus customary international law? All right. States, I shouldn't say that, but states almost always lose. All right. Treaty and executive order? Customary and executive order? Done that. Done that. See, I told you it'd go easier. Now we get to state versus treaty. State versus customary. State versus executive order. So that help everybody kind of get a sense of how these all interact with each other. Basically, if you are representing the United States and you want to pursue a claim in a federal court system, you want to be in federal court, and you typically want to be dealing with a treaty. That's the clearest, strongest, most enforceable commitment that translates into a domestic legal obligation. If you are trying to pursue an international obligation and it's conflicting with state law, you know, generally that's the best favorable position for the person arguing for the international norm, which is important because a lot of the norms we've talked about, when things like, for example, human rights, conflicting with state law, different question. All right, so we are now at the moment where I'm about ready to start launching into the UNFCCC, which is a perfect moment for us to draw the class to a close. Unless you guys have things you want to talk about or questions at this point. All clear? Okay, then for Wednesday, we'll start in with the UNFCCC. We are going to talk about Kyoto, mainly because Kyoto is still the progenitor for a lot of the mechanisms and tools we use for climate change law. And it sets the stage for Paris, which is Monday's discussion. I will ask everyone to sort of think about given the nature of climate change and how it's the ultimate super wicked problem, how this legal system we've designed that we talked about actually applies to the nature of climate change. If you were to write a treaty to deal with climate change that was effective, given the tools we have here, what works? Think about that, and then think about whether the UNFCCC and Kyoto come even close. And that's an open question. I do not have an answer for you on that one. I'm just curious what you guys think. Okay? Your last chance before you go out and enjoy the fall weather. You're free souls. I'll see you on Wednesday. Ha 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 ha!